It's just amazing. So we're going to keep working on Genesis, and we're going to finish Genesis by the end of the year. If not, we'll figure, you know, we'll do something else magical to figure it out. But it's looking good. And when it comes to where we're sitting now, it's the 14th, which means that next week we're off for Thanksgiving. I don't know about you guys. I have about 35 people coming. So we'll be cooking Wednesday. I've got to make turkeys and everything. So I don't know what all is going to happen, but it's going to be amazing. But that's next Wednesday, and Thursday, of course, is Thanksgiving. So we won't do that. And then that's the day that I have to be in Boulder. So then it's Fusion. So unfortunately, after tonight, I won't see you again until the 12th of December, which is kind of a pain, and I'm sorry. But we'll finish 12 and 19 December. That's Boulder. That's Boulder. That's an all-day, two-day-in-a-row event in Boulder, consulting stuff for the SRG company. So that's the thing that I have to do, because I've been working with them for a long time on the projects, and now they're coming to a head, and all the VIPs are coming in and stuff. So anyway, so we're going to do it. We got tonight and two more nights, and we're nearing the end. So it's not like a difficult journey. We'll make it. It's been a long journey. I mean, we've learned so much and seen so much. It's been pretty astounding. So, but we're gonna jump right back into it right now. So before we do anything, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for this time together. We want to thank you for being in our lives and blessing us and protecting us as we come and go. We're so grateful for everything, and we're speechless when it comes to the gifts that you bestow upon us, the ability to have this place to meet your word itself, your son, and everything that he did. I mean, there's so many things that we can't even begin to thank you. We welcome you in this place. We love you with all our hearts, and we ask you, please, bless our study of your word. Open the eyes of our minds and hearts to what you have to say to us. And just fill us with your love and your wisdom. Protect and bless everyone here. And we pray these things in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen. All right. So when we were last assembled, we were working on, you know, getting into the 40s. Now, we only have 50 chapters in Genesis, so we are, we're getting there. Now, when we're reading stuff, we use the New King James here. It's sort of the official version that's being used. But you'll notice that that's not really a thing at Radiant, right? Because you'll see the various pastors and speakers switching in and out of different, different versions whenever that, puts an idea more succinctly. We did a pretty in-depth study of 10 different versions and found almost no variation at all when it comes to the message. So you're pretty safe. Just remember, some of them are a little more lenient and easily readable, and some of them are a little more strict when it comes to the translation. And just keep an open mind and stay in prayer. Let the Holy Spirit guide you. You're going to be fine. If you want to go Old King James, you're still fine. It's just a little bit more difficult for most people to read. But the New King James actually takes all the discoveries since then when it comes to linguistics and various discoveries that have educated us about the language of the time and improved upon those understandings. And so it's based upon the King James. So you get that feel of the old, the old King James and that sort of rock, But you get the modernization in that we've learned a lot since 1611 about the culture of the time, about the way the Greek was expressed, for instance, linguistically. And we've talked about that. We've talked about how if I wrote a book right now and I used my common language, that there's keys in my common language that would tell people the time frame. Things I didn't say. So, like, for instance, there would be slogans and stuff I would say in the 60s that I wouldn't say today.
Flower power.
Like flower power. There'd be stuff that I wouldn't say now that I will say later. 2050, there'll be some slang that we don't have yet. So people can figure out you know, the time frame. And so that's one of the ways that they figure out, you know, like the people talk about lost books of the Bible or whatever, and one of the things they do is look at the language. If you go and pick up one of those, you know, quote-unquote lost, there's no lost books, okay, just to be clear. But if you go pick up like the Gospel of Thomas or something, all you have to do is read it, because you're well enough educated in the text and how it reads and how people write and how the language of the time works. You can just read it and you can tell. It's just written in a completely different time frame. There's a different structures. There's different words being used in different ways. And you can tell it's from several hundred years later. And that's what linguists, you know, analysts of text do. So over the years, 1611, that's been a lot of years, over 400 years, right? So, you know, 1611, they've discovered a lot of those nuances. And so they've been able to tweak. Even in the original King James, if you have one and you look at it, you'll notice that there's some italics, words in italics. That they did that to say we're not 100% sure. Like, we think this is the word, but we're not 100% sure. And so over the years, they've been able to eliminate a lot of those italics because they had more knowledge of the Greek of the time. So New King James tends to be the best of both worlds. It's modernized, but it still has its roots there. So that's why Radiant goes with that. It's not necessarily the absolute most accurate. That's probably, you know, that's probably, there's a couple other versions that are probably a little bit more specific with the Greek. And there's definitely easier to read versions like the NIV or, you know, ESV. And those are all very popular and easier to read. But in general, especially with the Holy Spirit protecting and guiding you, there's not a massive shift in understanding. It's not of a passage. It doesn't change the dramatic in a dramatic way typically. But we went through 41, and we were looking at those dreams, and we remember how Joseph, and our main message from the last class was the sovereignty of God, and basically how God uses all these things, including bad things, to turn into these wonderful good things. And how Joseph, you know, started off being sold into slavery and ended up as a slave, but then that made some connections there that helped. And then, of course, that ended up getting him thrown into prison. You know, some bad things happened to him, and now he's in prison. But his connection in prison with the you know, the guys that work for the Pharaoh, that comes back around as the you know, the guy remembers him interpreting the dream and says, "Oh, Pharaoh, you got to get hold of this guy. He can do that." So now he comes out and he interprets the dream, and we discovered he talks about the 7 years of plenty and how we need to store up everything. And then we got 7 years of famine coming, but we're going to be okay. We're going to figure that out. So the Pharaoh, being quite wise in this particular situation, says, "Well, if you're the one who figured it out, then you're the one who runs it. You run the program, collect all the stuff, set up the storehouses, and run it." So the Pharaoh took his signet ring and put it on Joseph's hand, and Joseph basically became the right-hand man of Pharaoh, basically running the show. We talked about this world of Joseph becoming Egyptian. We know that in the time frame, the Hebrews are going to stay within this time in Egypt. They're going to stay separate in a way. There's going to be a whole lot of back and forth happening over the years. We don't know all the details, but we know that Joseph, for instance, gets himself a wife and has kids, and that everybody is basically Egyptian, right? And so that's going to enter into our sort of calculations of the lineage, or whatever you want to call it. And so we've gone through this whole 7 years of plenty, and we've gathered everything. And now we've hit 7 years where there's going to be problems, and we get to Genesis 42 where Joseph's brothers are going to go to Egypt. Now, over the years we've put up a lot of maps and discussed all the stuff going on, so you guys know how this works, but there is a fertile crescent that runs all the way from Mesopotamia, where Tigris and Euphrates are, all the way around in a big arch that comes down through the Holy Land into Egypt where the Nile is. This is an unbelievably important part of the world because it's the core of the first two civilizations. You've got the first civilization of Mesopotamia that becomes the Akkadians, and that's what spawned Abraham. We talked about that. And then, of course, you've got Egypt, and you've got the pharaohs and all the pyramids and all that. And they're connected by this fertile crescent. That's why everybody's traveling like this. So the Bible, once again, is completely historically accurate and extremely logical. in how it describes that several times. And we have, as you know, historical climatologists have confirmed over and over again these periods of drought, you know, using dendrochronology involving tree rings, utilizing geology and stratifications of various kinds, stratigraphy techniques. We've determined over and over again that there's a period of these droughts. And we know there was a really big one right before Abraham, and that was the whole point of all the traveling, both the Egyptians and the Akkadians, the Sumerian, that those guys fell right before Abraham. So we've been able to track all this in the archaeological and historical records as well as the Bible and cross-reference it all. And there's been a record over and over again of these type of droughts. So in this case, we have a drought that's going to last for about 7 years. It's a sort of a mini drought. Okay, it's big for the people living at the time, but compared to the giant, crazy drought that caused the fall of the empires prior to Abraham, we have, it's not quite as bad. So the people that are experiencing it are looking around to try to find where they can get food, and they're looking in this Fertile Crescent. And of course, all the areas of the Fertile Crescent are getting hit by this drought. Egypt, the Levant, you know, the Holy Land, Mesopotamia, it's all getting hit. And so up there where Joseph's family lives, you know, Jacob's family, they're having problems. But they look down to Egypt, and they got two things that makes people go to Egypt all the time. Like, that's where Abraham went. Everybody goes to Egypt all the time, right? Egypt is safe. And the reason that Egypt is safer than the rest of the world, the reason that when Herod starts looking for Jesus, they flee to Egypt. The reason everybody's always fleeing to Egypt is sort of like the most stable in a way of all the countries and all the areas. But the most important part is the Nile. The rivers of Tigris and Euphrates and the Indus River, which is another civilization that forms over in India, and also the Yellow and Yangtze rivers over in China, the river cultures that developed, which is where the first human culture developed in cities and stuff, they're all very random. But the Nile is not, because the Nile is interconnected to a very large body of water down south and the Mediterranean up north. And what happens is it actually floods in a regular schedule that you can actually time your crops and stuff. Most of the other rivers are random. It'll flood sometime. We're going to have some kind of crops. But with Egypt, it's much easier to control and understand. And the pharaohs had gotten really good at doing some of that. So they can actually have big floodplains, and they can actually build things that will actually control water flow and everything, make canals. So they're getting really good at it. So they're very stable. Now you add to that Joseph's plan, and you got a real stable situation going on. Right now they've got plenty of food in Egypt, and everyone else is suffering. So this is why. This is the historical background. So when Jacob saw there was grain in Egypt, Genesis 42, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look to one another? Indeed, I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there that we may live and not die." Now, we know how wealthy Abraham's family, Isaac and Jacob, are. And we know what this means. It's said very simply in the Bible, but we know that it's going to take a lot of grain and a lot of money, because he's got a whole lot of people and a whole lot of animals and a whole lot of responsibilities. But the fact that he can send everybody down there to buy a ton of grain to bring back a caravan of grain is sort of an expression of the fact that they're still wealthy and they're still doing what they're doing in that Holy Land region. So they got plenty of money and plenty of power in the place that they're in. So he's like, go ahead, 10 guys, go down there, buy all the grain, get organized. He did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers. Okay, he's worried because Benjamin is youngest. You got to remember that Joseph and Benjamin are coming from his favorite wife, right? And she had lots of trouble having kids. He's got tons of kids, but these two are kind of special. And then Joseph's gone. So he's got Benjamin. He thinks she's dead, of course, right? So he's got Benjamin, and that's kind of his last kid of his wife that he loved. Plus, she's gone, so there's not going to be any more kids. Plus, he's the youngest. So he's not taking any chances with Benjamin. He's going to keep Benjamin at home, in a padded room, make sure he stays safe, okay, and send the other guys down there, because they're all, you know, tough farmer-type guys anyway, you know, Reuben and all those guys. So the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. So Joseph was governor over the land. And it was he who sold all the people of the land. This is so awesome. Sold there as a slave, and now he's the guy selling the grain to people, because and he had, you know, understood God's plan. Joseph's brothers came and bowed before him, and their face to the earth. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. You got to remember, this has been quite a few years. And he doesn't look like, first of all, he doesn't look anything like he would have looked anyway because he's so much older. But now he also looks Egyptian. And he also looks rich. So he doesn't bear like any resemblance to the Joseph that they knew. And so they don't, plus they're probably averting their eyes. They're probably not staring in his face. They don't want to create any offense or trouble, right? This guy is the key to their life or death. So he sees them. He's looking down at them, you know. So he's this is what I meant last time when I said Joseph's going to get show a little bit of his dad's genetics, okay? You remember how Jacob's a little, you know, a little shady here and there. He's doing a little trickery here and there. Joseph's going to play a few games because he's still his father's son, okay? So he recognizes his brother, don't recognize him. He remembered the dreams he dreamed about them. And so he's probably pretty happy inside, right? Because first of all, he sees them there alive. Second of all, he had this dream where they would bow before him, and they did, right? It's just such a turnaround, you know? So he says to them, "You're spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are no one's sons. We are honest men, your servants, not spies." But he said to them, "No, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land," right? And I don't know that phrase exactly, but I'm assuming that if you research the Hebrew in this case, it's gonna be a pretty fun saying. You know, they've got all these little slang sayings in the Bible that when you research them, they're really, really cool. Like what Jesus says on the cross to the guys, you know, to the thieves. It's slang that he uses, which is cool because they're like street people. Anyway, it's another class, but it's really cool. I'd say to you today, it's like it was a slang from the time. So historical linguists have found that phrase that they have in the Bible in other period texts. You know, "I say to you today." So it's like "yo, man." Like, so Jesus is on the cross, and of course he's a rabbi and highly educated. He's well spoken, right? He's been hanging out with the big guys in the temple since like 12, right? So, but he's speaking to the thieves, which are going to be street people. They're going to have a slang lingo. So what he says is "yo, man." He says, "I say to you today, you're going to be with me in heaven," right? And that helped them do the understanding of that translation, because originally they thought, "I say to you, today you'll be with me in heaven." They put the comma before the "today," so everybody thought they were going straight to heaven together. But they can't go straight to heaven. He's dead for 3 days, and he comes back to us for 40 before he ascends. So they don't go straight to heaven. But they figured that comma was supposed to be on the other side of the "today" when they found that slang. "I say to you today, you'll be with me in heaven." But that phrase in Greek. Anyway, that's another class. So the point is, this is probably slang, the nakedness of the land. So you've come to you know, basically to attack me. So, you know, there's been some, you know, adult content in Genesis so far, a few places, okay? We've had some adult content, okay? And this is related to that, like the idea of if you were a wild man and you saw a naked person, you would do things, right? So you're coming here to do that to me. You're coming here to rape me, to rape the land, to take away my stuff, right? That's the connection. That's why it says nakedness. They said, "No, your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. In fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more." So Joseph said to them, "It is as I spoke to you, saying, 'You are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here.'" So he's going to see his brother. That's his goal. But he's using it as a test, see, are they lying? Are they spies and are they lying about having a younger brother back home? So I'm going to test you as this, you know, Egyptian leader. And if you're not lying, go bring your brother back, right? But that's really his way to see his brother, you know, to see his younger brother, who he just loves to death. Send one of you, let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. Then Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to the prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die. Now we have been talking the whole time about Joseph and the reflections and the echoes of Jesus. Okay? And I just want you to see how many little reflections, echoes, and sort of ironic twists are in this passage. First of all, he locks them up. Remember how he's Jesus, right? In this sort of reflective way, you know, going down and then being risen up like that, and overcoming all these people trying to put sin on him that he didn't commit. And he's got all these reflections. He's like a mini Jesus. He's got these reflections of Jesus. But look at this. He puts them in prison, down in prison, for 3 days, and then lets them out. Right? So that he went down on the earth for 3 days, Jesus. Joseph puts them down there for 3 days. Then he lets them out and sends them, saying, I fear God, I don't want to, you know, be torturing you guys for no reason. You might be telling the truth. So everybody go, but leave one of your guys. So he's going to imprison one guy for the whole time they're gone, which is probably going to be roughly the amount of time he spent in prison. Right? So this is a reflection of what he did. He ended up in prison. Now a random one of those guys is about to end up in prison too. So there's all these echoes going back and forth. But they're in prison, and now he's released them from prison. He's set them free, right? So they did so. They said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. In other words, he wanted to go with them, right? Reuben answered them, saying, did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. Oh my goodness, look at this guy. He's speaking Egyptian, right? And he's got an interpreter for Hebrew. And they're talking Hebrew. He knows every word. Mm-hmm. He knows that. That's so cool. And he's a little shady. He's got a little Jacob in him, okay? I mean, that's just so cool. So he's like, he totally understands what they're saying. But I have no idea. They're like, this Egyptian, you know, Pharaoh-like leader guy is, you know, he's got this. He had to call for a translator. Can you imagine? A translator's probably like, but. He's like, no, don't say anything. Just translate. He's like, okay, because you speak better Hebrew than me. It's okay. All right, whatever you say. What a conversation that would have been. Anyway, I need a time machine. Okay, so Reuben is still the guy trying to, you know, to plead for everybody to do the right thing. He's still been doing that since the beginning. But they didn't know that Joseph understood what he said. So he turned himself away from them and wept. Okay. He's weeping because they're discussing, and he knows at least one of them had tried to stop it all from happening. He knows that Benjamin's still alive. He's just so overwhelmed with emotion about the whole thing that he's weeping. Then he returned to them again and talked with them. He took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. So he's, in a way, he's making a point. It's going to be a bigger deal. What is that? It tells you who it is or something? In a way, it's going to make it a bigger deal, right, when they realize who it is. But he's making a point because he is in charge. And he's in charge of their lives. At this point, he could have them all hemmed up and killed. No one would say a word. Pharaoh doesn't even know who they are, but he doesn't care. No one cares. He's second in charge. And all the guards are going to do is say, yes, sir, and kill these guys right here. So he takes one of them, has them bound right in front of him, put in prison. He put them in prison, let them out. He's not hurting them because it's only 3 days, right? And it's only one guy. He's not hurting anybody. But what he's doing is making a point. First of all, you guys got to pay at least some kind of price for what you did. Second of all, you're going to get rewarded at the end of this with all kinds of awesome food and greatness, and it's going to be amazing. And you don't just get that for free. Also, he's wise. Joseph is not young anymore, and he's not stupid. He has to check these guys' heart. You know, he knows that if he shows himself that they can't hurt him anymore. But do they have the best interest of his father and Benjamin at heart? Are they true? Have they learned their lesson? Are they worthy of the blessings he can give them? He needs to know. Why would you want to bless those guys that threw you in a pit if they're just going to try to figure out how to do that again? If they haven't learned any lessons, if they're not hurt by their own iniquities, their own problems that they caused. The reason he's weeping, I think, is because he's feeling that the majority of them just are so heartbroken because of what they did. They're truly sorry and regretful, which means they can be redeemed, right? You can't be redeemed for something you really aren't sorry about doing, you know? Forgive me for gambling, I'm going back to the casino tomorrow or whatever, you know? That doesn't really work. So he's trying to check their hearts. I think the reason he's so hard on them in a way is really to see how far they've come. Where are they really at? Right? He's going to do some more things to get to the answer, to get to the bottom. You know, you want to check to see where these people are. Have they gotten worse since you left? Or better? As people, right? So Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. So he not only gave them all the grain that they needed, but he gave them their money back. Okay? So they loaded their donkeys with the grain, departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give the donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money. And there it was in the mouth of the sack. He said to his brothers, "My money has been restored, and there it is in my sack." Then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, "What is this that God has done to us?" Like, what does this mean? Is this a blessing or a curse? Did we forget to pay? Did we not pay? Did they think we didn't pay? What is going on? So then they went to Jacob. So they make it back home. They go to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that happened, saying, "The man who is lord of the land spoke roughly with us. He took us for spies in the country. We said to him, 'We are honest men. We are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, the youngest with our father.' Then this man, the lord of the country, said to us, 'By this I will know that you're honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine to your household. Be gone. Bring your youngest brother to me, so I'll know you're not spies, but that you're honest man. I will grant your brother to you, and you may trade in the land.' Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle was money. The money was in their sack. When they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, 'You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. You want to take Benjamin. All these things are against me.' Then Reuben said to his father, saying, 'Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you.'" I'm kind of liking Reuben in these stories, okay? He keeps stepping up. He keeps trying to be the man he's supposed to be. And he's saying, "I will personally guarantee Benjamin's safety, and you can kill my sons if I do not bring him back." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is left alone." You got to remember how overwrought Jacob is concerning Benjamin, because Joseph is gone. And Benjamin is the only child he has of his beloved wife. And we're dealing with the fact that he's the youngest of all the kids. So he's really beside himself. "If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. So I will surely die if anything happens." So 43. "Now the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass when they had eaten up the grain," etc. So they didn't leave immediately to go back. You see what's happening? He's like, "No, you can't take Benjamin. If something happens on the road, It'll be the end of me. So he says no. So they stay and they eat the grain that they brought. But that's not enough. That's enough just to get through this part of the famine and bring him back to get more stuff, right? So they don't have enough. But when they had eaten the grain that they brought from Egypt, their father said, go back, buy us a little food. But Judah spoke, saying, the man solemnly warned us, saying, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man has told us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. So Israel said, why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you still had another brother? Like he's mad at him for mentioning Benjamin in the first place. Said, the man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our families, saying, is your father still alive? Have you another brother? And we told him according to those words. Could we possibly have known that he would say, bring your brother down? Then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I myself will be the surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back and set him before you, let me bear the blame forever. For if we had not lingered, surely by now we would have returned the second time. So he's up, and Judah's up in the ante, right? He's saying, I know that Reuben promised you his kids if he didn't bring him back. I'm going to give you me. You kill me if I don't bring him back. So now he's got two promises from two of the oldest kids that they're going to bring him back. And Judah's further explaining that if we hadn't lingered, we would have been back already with more food. And their father said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man. A little balm and a little honey, some spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. There's our pistachio nuts, right? Remember the terebinth trees, right? Abraham kept camping out. You guys weren't here for this. Abraham kept camping out on terebinth trees. We kept talking about, why does he love the terebinth trees so much? But we found out from research they're pistachios. So Abraham's big pistachio nut. The whole family loves them, evidently. So anyway, so take double money in your hand. Take back the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Maybe this was an oversight. Take your brother also. He has no idea what's going on. Maybe there was an oversight. Maybe somebody snuck it in the packs. Maybe they think they stole it. He doesn't know. But take double the money. That way you can pay both if they need you to. Take your brother also. Go back to this man. Take gifts for him. So he's setting up everything. May God Almighty have mercy before this man, and he may release your brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. Okay, so he's basically saying, I'm going to roll the dice on this. We've got to take this chance or we're going to starve. But I want you to notice what's going on. More reflections. They're traveling from faraway land, and they're coming, and they're bringing presents for Joseph, one of which is myrrh. And it's probably also the money, which is gold. And there's other spices, so who knows if frankincense are in there somewhere, right? But the bottom line is, it's a reflection, once again, of Jesus, right? You've got guys traveling from the east, wise men coming, bringing presents to Jesus. And you've got these bringing, and it's just enough. It's just enough of a hint to make me feel like there's a reflection going on. You know, we keep seeing these things where it sort of matches. In a miniature way, sort of matches Jesus. You know, what is he doing? I mean, what is Joseph doing? He's sitting in judgment of these guys. So he was the chosen one with his multicolored coat. Then he was down in slavery, and then he was in prison, and then he was elevated up to the second in power, the right hand of the father, the right hand of Pharaoh, right? And now he sits in judgment of these people. So see, so you've got his original state with the multicolored coat being pre-incarnate Jesus. You've got slavery being the life of Jesus on earth. You've got down in prison being the crucifixion and death. And you've got the rising up being the risen Jesus and the ascended Jesus, now sitting on the right hand of the Father, as you know, second in command or whatever, the right hand of the Father, and exercising judgment over everybody who comes and lines up in these lines before the white throne, or in this case, the Pharaoh's throne for all the grain. It's this beautiful reflection. It's not called prophecy. It's the story of Joseph, right? But it's very prophetic how it's laid out. It's like you should recognize, if you knew this, like let's say you were, say, a Pharisee, you should recognize this. You should recognize the reflections and that this man is indeed the Messiah. But you don't necessarily recognize those reflections. They, unfortunately, a lot of them didn't. But that's what's going on. So the men took that present and Benjamin and doubled their money and arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. And it's only one sentence, but that's a pretty good journey, by the way. Okay, so now they've been gone a while. They stood before Joseph. Now when Joseph saw Benjamin, you know, he's going to be fighting back tears, right? So he's gonna say to the steward of the house, take these men to my home, slaughter an animal to make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. Then the man did as Joseph ordered, of course, and brought those men to Joseph's house. And we know that Joseph has a recognizable and large house that can have such a gathering, right? And like I've said, archaeologically, we think we found it. We think we found Joseph's house. And there is a mini pyramid in the back, which it looks like a giant Egyptian home, but it has Hebrew-type design. So it's almost like a Hebrew rose to great power and had all the builders of Egypt build him a giant mansion. But it was a Hebrew mansion, but it was the size of a giant Egyptian mansion. And then when he dies, they build him a pyramid, not a full-size one like a pharaoh, but like a mini pyramid because he was that big a deal. And we have that. That exists. So we don't know for sure, but man, would that be cool. Okay, so anyway, that's probably the house. We probably have the house that they're going to right now, which is what I'm trying to say. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, now the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house. They thought it is because of the money which was returned to our sacks that we were brought in so they may make a case against us and seize us and make us slaves with our donkeys. Make us slaves with our donkeys. I love that. I love the way that's phrased. When they drew near the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house and said, "Oh, sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food, but it happened when we came to the encampment, we opened our sacks, and there was each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Our money was full weight, so we have brought it back in our hand, and we have brought down other money for buying food. We do not know who put the money in our sacks." So the steward of Joseph's house says, "Peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money." Then he brought Simeon out to them. So the man brought the men into Joseph's house, gave them water, washed their feet. Are you tracking? Washed their feet, gave their donkeys feed. So this guy is the steward of Joseph's house. So this guy is far more powerful than these guys in Egypt, right? I mean, he's the right-hand man of the right-hand man. And yet someone that powerful that has their life in his hand basically is washing their feet. You understand? So he gives their donkeys feed, and they made a present ready for Joseph's coming at noon, for they heard that he would eat bread there. When Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand in the house, bowed before him to the earth. Like they had that in there for a reason. They didn't bow like howdy. They went all the way to the ground, face first. I mean, forehead to the dirt. Okay, that's where they're at in their lives compared to Joseph right now, just like the dream. But anyway, he asked them about their well-being and said, "Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" And they answered, "Your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive." They bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves again. Now they're full out flat on the ground. Then he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Now his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. So he's in the middle of talking to them, getting lunch set up, accepting their present. They're full on the ground, face down, and he has to run out to bawl. Because he just is overwhelmed with, he's looking at his brother's face. He's seeing that his father's still alive, his brothers are alive. He's getting a very strong feeling from the Holy Spirit that these guys are going to make things right, that they're good people. Things are going the way they're supposed to go. This is being blessed. So he went to his chamber and wept there. Then he washed his face, came out, restrained himself, and said, "Serve the bread." He's all Egypt out with this thing, and he's like, "Serve the bread," trying to be all tough. It's just so cool. So they set him a place by himself, and them by themselves. And the Egyptians who ate with him ate by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. Look at the twist. So we don't have the law yet, right? Remember, that's still going to be written down later. That's Moses, right? Right now, the stuff the Hebrews eat is considered an abomination by the Egyptians. How's that for a twist? Because they're having whatever weird, you know, Hebrew stuff they're eating, and the Egyptians are like, "That's horrible. I don't know how you do that to that poor lamb," or whatever they're eating, right? But it's got to be Hebrew food. So that's just fascinating. So they set before him the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked in astonishment at one another. Then they took servings to them from before him. But Benjamin's serving was 5 times as much as any of theirs. So they drank and were merry with him. So they're just having a big old party. They've got, the Egyptians are separate. The Hebrews are separate, but they're in this big room having this party. And they're astonished because they thought it probably was a trick, some kind of trap. But the fact is, they're having this party and it's real. And they look at each other like in astonishment that there is real. Did you find something in like the study Bible that was interesting? They got drunk with each other. There is a whole lot of drinking and partying going on. Like I said, Jesus does do some drinking and some partying with his people. That's the Last Supper. That's the first thing he does with Matthew. That's the first miracle, is making wine at the wedding. I mean, there is this quality of having a meal and dining and drinking and being together. This camaraderie is permeating this. And it's yet another reflection of the way Jesus lived. You know, my favorite verse for my chef life, you know, Matthew 11:19, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. Okay? It's the core of how he did ministry. He would get everybody together and have a food and drink and talk and stuff. You know? And that's exactly what's happening here. And they're just astounded. They can't even be. And then Benjamin gets a giant, like a pile of stuff. You know, it's like, this is so great. So, Genesis 44, we're going to talk about Joseph's cup now and a little bit more trickery. Okay. So, he commanded the steward of the house, saying, "Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry. Put each man's money back in the mouth of their sack again." Okay. "Also put my cup, the silver cup." So he's got like a royal type cup, like this special, really nice, really expensive cup, "in the mouth of the sack of the youngest and his grain money." So he did according to the word that Joseph spoke. This guy does exactly what Joseph says every time to the letter. "As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys. When they had gone out of the city and they were not far off, Joseph said to his steward, 'Get up, follow the men. When you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good?" So why have you done this evil for what good was done to you? Is this not the one from which my Lord drinks? Because you're going to be able to recognize his cup. Maybe it has a monogram or whatever, or gems, but you're going to recognize Joseph's cup. It's his royal type of cup. And now listen to this part. And we're going to have to talk about this. "Is this not the one from which my Lord drinks, the one with which he practices divination? You have done evil in so doing." Now, there's a couple possible translations here. There's a couple possible understandings. Understanding number one, Joseph does divination, basically Egyptian-style magic. He's Egyptian, after all. It's possible. Number two, he talks to God, gets words from God, does Christian things, but this guy thinks it's divination. Because how else would he know this stuff? How does he know about these things? Because maybe he's having a drink and he's staring into his cup thinking about what God's saying to him. And the guy's like, okay, somehow he's finding out what these dreams mean. Right? So, I don't know. But he mentions that, which I find fascinating. There's a few things in the Bible like that. They're scary and they're worth discussing. You know, we talk about, I had a little class about this a long time ago. And it was about God being the greatest and most powerful of all gods. And it says that over and over in the Bible. Take no other gods before me, I'm the greatest of all the gods, etc. But being the greatest of all the gods implies that there's other gods, right? And, you know, demonic forces, lords of demons, whatever they are, right? The point is that we know the stories, like the Pharaoh's magicians throw down their staves, they turn into serpents. You know, Moses and Aaron throw down their staff, turns into a bigger serpent, eats those serpents. We tend to forget the fact that those guys just threw down sticks and made snakes. That's crazy. So they did something powerful and magical. We overlook the fact that over and over again there's these references to this sort of spiritual magical world that's not specifically always of God. So there's a power there. There's some kind of fighting going on. We've got people following around some of the disciples like Paul, and that she's following them around and she's speaking the truth. Right? She got the truth from the wrong place, but she still got the truth. Demons know Jesus. Mm-hmm. Right? And so there's all this confusion. So maybe this is something like that. I don't know. But we have these things like, so Saul is about to die, and the great prophet Samuel has told him he's going to die. He's upset about it. So he goes and gets a witch and says, call up Samuel. Let's talk. And she does. And Samuel comes and says, why are you bothering me? I told you, you're going to die. That's it. That's the word of God. It's over. And he dies, right? But there, a witch just did that. That's weird, right? That's crazy. So we have always to remember that even though there is a power in us and a power in God that is unstoppable and thousands of billions of times more powerful than anything else. So it's creator, everything else is created. So nothing else matters. No matter how big a demon is, it doesn't matter. There's creator and everything. It's like saying that's the biggest ant. It doesn't matter. Okay? But we still have to remember that there's still those powers. That we're still coming up against them. Like Paul says, we're still facing those powers. And I don't know if Joseph is flirting with that, like some kind of, you know, Bible students playing with a Ouija board. I don't know, right? I don't know if that's what the guy thinks he does, because he knows he does something. He just doesn't understand God, maybe. I don't know. But we have all these things throughout the Bible that show us continually there's other stuff going on the other side, and we have got to watch ourselves. We got to be careful. So if that does mean that, Joseph's going to have to get right, or maybe something's going to go horribly wrong, like, say, 400 years of slavery. But, you know, I don't know. But that just fascinates me when they get, like, the story with Saul, mm-hmm. and that this practice of divination with this cup thing. This type of stuff fascinates me, and I'm always trying to study to see what God's trying to say. And I think the main message of all of it is watch yourself, because it's real. Mm-hmm. A witch can call up Samuel. How does that even work? I don't know. But it happened. So watch yourself, because that's scary. Anyway, I don't want to sidetrack us, but this is the one, the cup he packs his divination with. That's crazy. Okay? So he overtakes him. He speaks the same words he said. This guy does exactly what he says every time to the letter. Said to him, why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servants should do such a thing. Look, we brought back from you the land of Canaan, the money from the mouth of our sacks. How then will we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever of your servants is found, let him die. Oh, you shouldn't be talking so quick. And we also will be the Lord's slaves. So they're saying, we haven't done anything like that. If you find that cup in anybody's bag, let that person die and we'll be your slaves. This is not, you should not talk that quick. So the lesson here is be quiet and listen first. Do not start shooting your mouth off, whoever that is, probably Judah. Okay, do not be shooting your mouth off. Now he said, now let it be according to your words. With whom it will be found shall be my slave, and you shall be blameless. So then each man speedily let down his sack to the ground, each opened his sack, and so he searched. He began with the oldest and left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So they're just like ripping their clothes, because that's a symbol in that culture of just utter distraught. Like you're just broken and destroyed. Like your wife dies or whatever, and your kid dies. You just rip your clothes. They're so distraught. They have no idea what's happened, because they've been truthful, right? But something has happened. Whether one of them's lying and stole that cup, or what is going on, they don't know. But they know it's really, really bad. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there. They fell on the ground before him, and Joseph said to them, "What deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?" Fascinating, huh? And then Judah said, "What shall we say, my lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of our servants. Here we are, my lord's slaves, both we and he, also with whom the cup was found." And he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. As for you, go up in peace to your father." Now, we get another talk about this divination. So we got a third possibility. Remember I told you there's three possibilities? The first one was he does it. The second one is the guy thinks so. The third one is, remember how the guy always does exactly what he says to the letter? He might have told him that to throw them off the scent. Tell them that's the cup I do divination with. They bring it back. He's like, "That's my cup I do divination with. Don't you know? I do divination. I can find you. I can find out where my cup is." He's talking like an Egyptian magician to confuse them. That's my feeling. It's a trick, kind of like his dad did with the, you know, weird skin on his arms and stuff like that. I think what he's doing with all of this is testing them. What are they going to do? How are they going to react? Are they going to try to flee? Are they going to try to lie about it? Are they going to stand in front of him and say, "We have no idea what happened"? They're going to tell the truth. "This cup, I don't even know what happened, but we're going to be your slaves now because we said we would be, but I don't even know what's going on." I mean, what is really happening? Because they really don't know. How are they going to react? And what are they going to do when he says, "I'm just going to keep the younger one as my slave"? Because the one that they're little, that they both said, "If we come back without him, you can kill me or my kids." Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to take him as my slave, and you can go back without him. So first of all, did he practice divination and know they said that? Or did God tell him? Or is he just doing what he wants to do? And he wants Benjamin to be with him, right? All we know is that this is like a really serious sitcom, okay? But like one of those plots where the story is unfolding and twisting and turning all the time. Because now those guys are thinking, okay, first of all, we look like thieves, and we're not. I don't know what happened with the cup or the money. Second of all, if we don't go back with him, people are going to die. Jacob's going to lose his mind. Third of all, we can't leave Benjamin here. This guy's crazy. This guy's an Egyptian magician. He could turn him into a frog. I don't know what's going to happen. You know,